Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
And just when you thought we might be reaching the bottom of the slippery slope, it seems we keep having farther to fall. Death with dignity has become one of the catchphrases, I would say, of the culture of death. And what people might mean by that, of course, is that society needs more suicide and euthanasia in order to function well. And why do I have the feeling we've been down this road before? Death with dignity is our topic today. 888-318-7884 is our number. 888-318-7884. If you are a supporter of suicide and euthanasia, please give us a call and we'd love to discuss it with you. Or if you're not sure, we hope we can sway you maybe to the less violent options at the end of life. Or maybe you just have questions about the current efforts to legalize suicide and euthanasia around the country and around the world. 888-318-7884 is the number. Our guest this hour is Jason Negri. Jason is the assistant director of the Patients' Rights Council, which you can find at patientsrightscouncil.org. It's an organization committed to addressing euthanasia, assisted suicide, disability rights, pain control, and other things. Jason lives in Michigan, where he's an estate planning attorney, adjunct attorney. I don't think I said that right. Adjunct professor of business law. And one of my favorite things about you, Jason, you're the treasurer of the Hamburg Township. Jason Negri, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So they trust you with the money?
They do. Well, at least they have for a few months. We'll see what happens.
All right. I hope that's not a premonition. You wrote a booklet for Catholic Answers, 20 Answers on the End of Life Issues.
Mm-hmm. I did.
And how long ago did you write it?
It was published in 2014, so I guess I probably spent a fair bit of 2013 writing it.
And the efforts to kind of spread this idea of assisted suicide and euthanasia have continued apace, even intensified in recent years.
Yeah, they certainly have. It's an issue that people, especially Americans, don't like to talk about at all. We're horribly uncomfortable with the idea of death. The only context that people really have been talking about it lately is when it either happens in their own families and they're forced to deal with it, or if it comes up in the context of a legal effort to make doctor-prescribed suicide or assisted suicide legal and acceptable and a medical treatment. And then people start talking about it and weighing in on both sides of the issue. So, yeah, it's heated up a lot.
And do we have – it seems to me that we have some countries around the world that are kind of cutting edge on this, and they can give us a sign of a little bit of a signal. This is where it's going if you go down this road. And I don't know what you would – the Netherlands comes to mind.
Sure.
Are there others that come to your mind? And can you tell us a little bit about where these innovations have led already?
Belgium, of course, is one of the other countries where this has happened. A 2010 study published by the Canadian Journal of Medical Ethics actually found out that in the Belgian region of, I think it was Flanders, I'm pretty sure it was Flanders, found out that about 32% of all euthanasia deaths in that region were carried out without the patient's explicit request. So for all this talk about, you know, it being something that it's a right, it's a need that people have, and it's only going to be limited to the people who need it and ask for it, that certainly has not been proven true in Belgium.
888-318-7884 is the number. Death with dignity is our topic this hour. Jason Negri is our guest. Happy to take your calls. 888-318-7884. And also, I note that there have been some reports out of Europe that maybe it may be Belgium, maybe the Netherlands, that people are being euthanized or are taking the route of physician-assisted suicide for things like depression.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And one of the major contributing factors is loneliness.
Yes. And there's no doubt people were much more atomized and lonely than we were, you know, in previous generations. But that what started off with all these alleged legal safeguards, that it was only going to be used for people who had terminal medical conditions, only 6 months left to live, things like that. Now they're using all sorts of reasons for why they might qualify for what they're calling death with dignity. And whether it's assisted suicide and somebody else is, you know, giving them what they need to do it themselves, or the possibility that they might be euthanized with an injection of some sort. That's been happening too, for reasons like going blind or loneliness, or what should be really scary is mental issue, you know, mental health, yes, depression issues, because that stuff that you know could and should be very treatable. And once people get out of the depression, whatever's causing their depression, many people realize they no longer want to die. It's very much a motivating factor. People aren't realizing this.
And it does seem that if the more you have of this quote unquote death with dignity, the more vulnerable people become vulnerable. Their vulnerability increases. It doesn't decrease.
Well, really, that's true. And that's essentially our main concern at the Patients' Rights Council, at least, is the idea that a whole bunch of people that we would call medically vulnerable for whatever reason, you know, yeah, some of which we've talked about here, but there's other reasons. They are very susceptible to the pressure that always accompanies available and accepted doctor-prescribed suicide. Here in America, especially the whole idea of elder abuse, it's very much an issue now. And I'm glad it is. I'm glad we are finally, as a nation, focusing on the issue of elder abuse and how terrible it is that so many elders in our midst, in our communities, are being abused largely by their caregivers. Well, that's a perfect setup for doctor-prescribed suicide to enable it and to cover their tracks and to make it an even worse epidemic than it is right now.
888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. So what's the maybe you as a lawyer, but also as a person involved in this movement to protect the vulnerable at the end of life? What's the primary question people ask, or maybe I don't mean a challenge to you, but I mean a question like, well, what about this, or how do I do this?
Well, actually, it is kind of a challenge. I would say the most common thing I hear from people is why are you denying people this right? I understand why you don't want it, but why would you deny me or somebody who is in this condition the right to have what the term you've been using, death with dignity? You know, that's the reason that they use. And it's really hard to get beyond that, because especially here in America, we are so focused on radical autonomy. We've become so used to talking in the language of rights. Everything is a right. Things that our forefathers, when they founded this country, never would have dreamed would have been a right are now seen as commonplace. So I think that's probably the biggest thing. It's hard to get past that issue of autonomy. My life, my choice, my time to choose when and how I'm going to die. Now, for some people, merely just pointing that out, they take a step back and they say, oh, wait, yeah, I guess that's right. It's not necessarily something that I ought to say is a right. But for a whole lot of people, they have a real problem with this. They want to be able to choose when they're going to die. And this is what the other side says that they're going to give for them.
Yeah.
And really, the only way to talk about this with people who bring that argument up, you kind of have to tease it out and make them see the truth that this isn't just about them. This isn't just about you and your alleged right to die. You used the term earlier, the medically vulnerable, the people who are going to be unwillingly swept up in this deadly embrace of doctor-prescribed suicide, whether they're out of coercion, you know, or pressure from other people to just quietly get out of the way. People who are elderly and people who have disabilities, they know firsthand what it's like to be marginalized by society, and particularly by the medical establishment. They face all kinds of obstacles and difficulties getting the care that they want because they're already kind of looked at askance and seen as not quite worth what we're going to be spending on them. So you throw, you know, a relatively cheap solution of doctor-assisted suicide into the mix, and it becomes the solution of choice for some people. It's unfortunate, but people, you have to bring that out. You have to make people realize that it's not just the short-term solution that the other side is saying that it is. It's going to have a ripple effect to a lot of other people.
Death with Dignity is our topic today. Jason Negri, the Assistant Director of the Patients' Rights Council, is here to help us work through all the issues involved in that. 888-318-7884 is the number. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come right back with calls for Jason Negri on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties is the new book by apologist Trent Horn. A comprehensive look at dozens of the most confounding passages in Scripture that offers clear, reasonable, and Catholic keys to unlocking their true meaning. Don't be left without an answer again. Order your copy of Hard Sayings today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In John 10:31, when the people picked up rocks to stone Jesus, he said, "I have shown you many good works from my Father. For which of these are you trying to stone me?" They replied that he was a man and was trying to make himself God. He replied that if he did not perform his Father's works, then they need not believe him. But if he did perform such works, they ought to at least recognize that they were the works of his Father, and that obviously there had to be some connection between the Father and himself. Such obvious logic was beyond them. At this point, such a possibility was far more than they were willing to entertain. They had completely closed their minds to him, as well as their hearts. We can ask ourselves how open our minds and hearts are to him. What are the ramifications of following him that are too much for us? But remember, he did perform those works, and he proved his love for us with his own blood. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks to everybody watching today on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, or Periscope. If you're watching there, you have two choices about how to get your questions to us. You can call, as just as listeners do, at 888-318-7884. Or you can type in a question, and we will do our very best to get to those typed-in questions. Our guest this hour, Jason Negri, Assistant Director of the Patients' Rights Council, an attorney who deals with end-of-life issues a good deal himself, also the author of 20 Answers, one of the 20 Answers books here at Catholic Answers on end-of-life issues. And we are, in fact, talking about end-of-life issues today. 888-318-7884 is that number. Jason, do you feel comfortable going right to calls, or want to wrap anything up that we were talking about before?
Yeah, we could take some questions and just kind of see where the conversation goes, if you like.
That sounds great. Okay, Aura in Rochester, New York, listening on 92.9 FM. You are on with Jason Negri. What's your question?
Hey, Jason. How are you guys doing today?
Good, thank you.
Doing great. How are you?
Awesome. I'm doing well. So we were talking about mercy killing. My question is specifically on mercy killing. And what the stance is on that. For instance, over the past week, we've seen a lot of horrifying material come out of Syria with the chemical bombings that happened there. And in the instance of assured death, would a mother be justified in taking the life of their child if they understood that because they didn't want them to suffer at the hands of that could take hours and hours.
Sure.
What would your response to that be?
Okay, you have to understand that I'm not a philosopher or a theologian. So my focus on this issue tends to be one from a public policy and legal point of view. So while I can tell you that I understand from a philosophical point of view that battlefield euthanasias, I can totally understand why that would have taken place, at certain times in history. But here in America and in modernized countries where we have the medical technology and capabilities that we do, there really is not much of a justification for doing something like that. First of all, the fundamental philosophical principle that we all tend to accept is it's always morally wrong to take an innocent human life. Bare bones. That's a pretty decent principle that I think has guided Western civilization reasonably well for a couple of millennia. So the short and easy answer to your question would that no, mercy killing would not be all right. But particularly, I think it's just not necessary with the medical technology that we have right now. We can keep people comfortable. We may not necessarily always be able to cure them. And you have to understand that distinction. A cure is not always possible. We are still mortal. And at some point, we all have to reconcile with our mortality. But to affirmatively kill somebody else even for the good motive of avoiding them suffering, I think is morally problematic. And again, in the first world, and especially in America where we are right now, it should never be necessary.
Thank you very much, Aura, for that call. Jason, that raises a kind of question about making public policy based on the most extreme possible scenario. That's not a way to make public policy, is it?
No, not for any issue. You can't take a hard case and try to craft an appropriate, generally applicable policy that's going to apply to the general public. What do they say? Hard cases make bad law, and that's true in pretty much any situation, particularly here.
And because if we allow those hard cases to make the law, then that means then the vast majority of people are ruled by a law that just simply doesn't apply in their situation, and that will give us bad results. And we would say, well, if mercy killing is okay in this extreme instance, say we did say that, mm-hmm. well then. That being such a rarity, we've now made mercy killing acceptable in many instances that are not extreme at all.
Which I think goes back to the beginning of our conversation about what's been happening over in Europe, where we see what starts off as an option for the truly desperate has rapidly expanded to become an expectation for many people. I know we talked a little bit more about Belgium, but the situation in the Netherlands is actually a little bit more on point because there's a very well-known Dutch ethicist, Dr. Theo Boer, who's gotten a lot of notoriety lately because he was called in to testify when the United Kingdom was considering an assisted suicide bill back in 2015. They brought in Dr. Boer from the Netherlands because he wanted to tell them, and he told them point blank, don't repeat our mistake. Because he watched it happen over the course of years, something that started off with the best of intentions, cabined in by very strict restrictions, was only going to be applicable to the truly desperate cases of terminal patients who were in tractable suffering. And that he watched it expand over 10 years to include more and more and more people in various types of circumstances that it was never intended to cover, to the point where in the Netherlands, in the city of Amsterdam, they apparently only have two tiny little hospices to serve the entire city of 1.2 million people. So there's definitely an effect on the medical establishment in terms of where they're putting their resources. If it's expected that people are just going to do away with themselves or ask for the medical establishment's help in killing themselves, well, then we don't really need to spend quite as much money in researching pain control or hospice or any of these other things for the people who don't want to go like that. That the societal pressure goes hand in hand as we accept euthanasia or assisted suicide in some circumstances. Experience has shown us that it's going to expand to other circumstances where it was supposedly never intended to.
We go now to Elliot in Covington, Louisiana, listening on 690 AM. Elliot, you are on with Jason Negri. What's your question?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to run this by you and see if what I did was the right way from a Catholic perspective to explain. I happen to be in a master's program right now for nursing, Loyola University, New Orleans, and our topic this week happens to be the right to die. We were asked to compare and contrast passive euthanasia versus assisted suicide and active euthanasia. Passive being not necessarily the term that I like, but withdrawal of life support, so to speak. So the way I did this, I said, okay, you have to start with life, and you've got a natural lifespan, and when you have passive euthanasia or the removal of life support, that lifespan is headed towards a natural end. And by removing life support, you're not necessarily hastening death. You're allowing what would have happened without the medical treatment to happen. Versus with active euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, you're taking the natural lifespan once again, and you're adding to that a medical treatment which hastens unnaturally death. So,
all right.
I mean, that was the basic gist of it. And so I'm just wondering, is that the right way to go about it, or should I add something to that?
Jason Negri, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think you did a pretty good job. I don't like the term – I've never liked the term passive euthanasia as a descriptor for when you remove life-sustaining medical treatment. I understand some places use that term, and that's okay. But the euthanasia itself always seems to denote a deliberate act by somebody else to affirmatively cause the death of another, where, and that's always to be distinct from removing life-sustaining medical treatment and simply allowing natural death to occur. Ethicists and lawyers have always accepted that there's a tacit difference between those two things in terms of intentionally and affirmatively causing a death versus simply allowing death to take place. But I think you articulated it fine.
Thank you very much for that, Elliot. And is that why the Patients' Rights Council is involved in issues of pain management?
Certainly, because, of course, that's one of the essential issues that the other side uses as their standard for why they want to. They create a very sympathetic situation of a patient who is experiencing pain, and they say, this is why we need this. And, of course, anybody with a reasonable amount of sympathy and heart is going to look at that and say, oh, gosh, we have to do what we can. Well, they had been able to claim a lot of moral high ground by saying that they're truly the compassionate ones. Matter of fact, they even have that in their name. The major pro-assisted suicide organization in America is called Compassion and Choices. They deliberately changed their name from the Hemlock Society for that reason, because they're positioning themselves as the compassionate response. So in an attempt to point out and underscore the reality that, hey, we really do care about people who are suffering. Matter of fact, our solution is better than yours. It forced us to look into this a little bit more and to publish this book called Power Over Pain. It's co-authored by a doctor and a lawyer, and the doctor is board certified in pain control, really to help people understand the issues involved in pain control. And there's a whole lot of doctors out there who simply don't get it. No matter how good they may be in their specialization, they don't understand pain control. And you really do need – if you're experiencing this, you need to find a doctor who understands it. And hopefully this book can help you. If anyone is interested in this book, you can get it through the Patients' Rights Council.
I have a fear. We have this thing in California where we're so into abortion on the state level that we don't do anything to help with adoption. There's a kind of almost like allergy to adoption. I wonder if there's a parallel that if we get into suicide and euthanasia, that will mean, oh, we got to stay away from all that pain management stuff. And we actually won't get better at it because it'll be seen as, no, that's kind of undermining this other way that we've decided to go.
I'm not saying you're wrong. It could happen that way. What I think is possibly more likely is if we as a society embrace assisted suicide as a medical treatment, it's going to become the new standard of care.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to become the expected way that people in these conditions are going to check out. And if that becomes the expectation, whether you're talking about what insurance is going to cover, and we're already seeing examples of that, of insurance companies refusing to pay for therapeutic treatments but offering to pay for assisted suicide where it's legal. So whether it's the insurance company doing a little bit of coercion, whether intentionally or not, or just a general ethos in society of saying, this is our solution. We think that this is the way that everybody ought to go. You wouldn't want to live like this, would you? And the more that becomes coalesced in our thinking as a society, the less resources we're going to invest in any alternatives like natural death, pain control, hospice, mm-hmm. all these good things.
Right. 888-318-7884 is the number. Anonymous in Louisiana, listening on Catholic Radio 690. I'm going to ask you to get your question out, and we may get the answer in before the break. We may have to wait till after the break to get the answer in. But Anonymous, go ahead and share your question with us.
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes.
You can. All right. My mother is 94 years old. And she's gotten through colon cancer, bladder cancer, and a heart valve surgery. And the hospital who did the heart valve surgery, they sent her home, and they told us to call hospice. She was in the hospital 3 months. She was weak. She was getting reactions from all the medicines. I would like to know, how will we know who has adopted this idea of, you know, letting people go, or doctors not caring for the patient after a certain time?
But when you say who has adopted this, do you mean like who as far as which hospitals or which states or?
Right. Which states? Which states are going to, will we know?
We're going to have to take a quick break. Jason Negri, Assistant Director of the Patients' Rights Council, is here to answer questions. And we will ask Jason that very question when we come back in just a moment on Catholic Answers Live.
Glad you're with us. Join us on air with your questions today on Catholic Answers Live.
It may be true for you, but not for me. How often have you heard this during a discussion with friends or family? Whether talking about faith, morality, politics, or just the basic notion of truth, so many people are captive to the notion of relativism, the belief that reality is something we decide. In his new audio presentation, Your Truth, My Truth, apologist Carlo Broussard breaks down this intellectual cancer, looking at the different kinds of relativism we regularly encounter and demonstrating how, ultimately, they collapse under the weight of their own incoherence. More importantly, Carlo makes a powerful case for the existence of objective truth, showing you how to explain to others that right and wrong are both real and universal, because it was designed that way by God. Order your copy of Your Truth, My Truth by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Atheists have a new tactic when it comes to talking about the existence of God. Your arguments in favor of God don't even deserve a reply, they say. Because not only does God not exist, he doesn't even matter. In his new DVD, Why God Still Matters, apologist Carlo Broussard doesn't let them off so easy. He takes apart the premises of those who say God's irrelevant and teaches you what you need to demonstrate why God is just as important. In fact, in today's world, more important than ever. Don't let atheists shut down the argument before it begins. Get your copy of Why God Still Matters by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So happy to have you here with us. We are talking a tough subject this afternoon. Death with Dignity is a movement, maybe the latest movement in the advancement of the culture of death, but it's not an inevitable advancement. There are things we can do to defend life and to stand up for the principle that each and every human life is precious from the moment of conception until natural death. 888-318-7884 is our number. 888-318-7884. Our guest, Jason Negri, has worked in this area a very long time. He is an attorney who deals with end-of-life issues, and he's also the assistant director of the Patients' Rights Council. And Jason, when we went to the break, our anonymous caller from Louisiana was asking about, is there any way to know what various jurisdictions allow or permit or forbid as far as assisted suicide and euthanasia?
Yeah, and actually a running list of this that is as close to real time as you can get is maintained on the website of the Patients' Rights Council. And you mentioned at the beginning of the program, www.patientsrightscouncil.org. You can look and check and see on the issues on a state-by-state basis. But I can say right now, no state in America has legalized euthanasia, and they're not even talking about it. Euthanasia is something that Europe right now is dealing with, unfortunately. But from a legal and public policy perspective, nobody in America is really talking about euthanasia. It's all on assisted suicide. And there's only a couple of jurisdictions. There's only a few states that have accepted doctor-prescribed suicide as a medical treatment. It started in Oregon and then spread to Washington, then Vermont, then California, and then Colorado. And the District of Columbia, of course, they passed their own law last month too. So within Washington, D.C. itself, it's also been accepted. And then Montana has kind of a weird legal system. It's not actually legal there, but they had a court case that made it kind of a strange status on its own. But those are really the only jurisdictions where it's accepted. But if you keep an eye on the Patients' Rights Council website, we keep a pretty good close eye on it ourselves. So far, 25 different states have introduced bills just this year to legalize assisted suicide. Those of them a number of them have rejected them already, but the count right now at the beginning of April is half of the United States have made efforts to legalize it at this point.
PatientsRightsCouncil.org is the website. You can go there for up to the minute, practically, information on what is happening on the legal front across the United States. The general methodology, or one of the methodologies of the culture of death, has been to fight these things at the level of the state until you can get it heard in a federal court, and then hopefully you get the Supreme Court to say, oh, forget all those state laws, the 14th Amendment. That's all, it always seems to be the 14th Amendment says you could do whatever you want. And so or you have to do it, you know, whatever the issue is. So is there any danger of that as far as suicide and euthanasia, that strategy might pay off, or is it different in the federal courts?
No, it is very much a possibility. This issue did make it to the United States Supreme Court back in 1997 in Vaco v. Quill and Washington versus Glucksberg. Usually when, you know, we talk about the Supreme Court case, well, it's usually a bunch of cases together. So they've merged them. And when the Supreme Court dealt with this in 97, they actually decided in a unanimous 9-0 decision that the right to die, as it was articulated by the assisted suicide folks, does not appear to be a constitutional right. So there is no federal constitutional right to die. However, there was language in the opinion that left open the possibility that this would be worked out, as they quote, in the laboratory of the states. So it very much left open the possibility that if enough states on a state-by-state basis jumped on this bandwagon, this issue could be revisited in the U.S. Supreme Court at some point in the future, and they very well might reach a different conclusion. So yeah, it is a danger.
888-318-7884 is the number. We now go to Bobby in Birmingham, Alabama. Bobby, you are on with Jason Negri. What's your question?
Well, you've sort of just actually anticipated my question perfectly. We've seen these trends. We've seen it's partial what you talked about. It's good, though. It's a good topic. We've seen the trends in Scandinavia. Anything really wacky and really evil starts in Scandinavia, and it then finds its way to Canada, Washington State, Oregon. Okay, so we've gone through this from marijuana to sodomy-based marriage to abortion to a variety of things, and we've seen the creep of it, how it creeps into our society. So my question is, with marijuana legalized, with abortion, with a sodomy-based marriage, it seems to me it's just a sort of foregone conclusion until this happens, as he just mentioned, with the Supreme Court. So my question for the policy expert is, and he sort of anticipated it, what's really holding it back? I mean, this seems to be the least offensive, really. Don't get me wrong. How do you say what's less offensive, a flamethrower or a nuclear weapon? But in terms of sodomy, in terms of euthanasia, abortion, I mean, this – I'm surprised it hasn't happened already. This is the part that's astounding to me. This seems to fit perfectly with modern American culture and ethos of utilitarian, no pain, pleasantries. And I'd like to hear when he thinks this is going to happen. In other words, the Roe v. Wade of suicide choice.
Okay. Jason Negri.
It's a good question. I think you're unfortunately right that of all the issues that you mentioned, it does seem to be a pattern. And you're surprised that this one hasn't been taken up wholeheartedly on the federal level for America yet. People still do have a visceral reaction when they really think about it and really look into what's involved here. People still do have a visceral reaction against the idea of somebody helping someone else kill themselves. You know, suicide is still suicide as itself is still very much recognized as a tragedy. And have we seen in individual cases, Massachusetts, for example, when the issue was first floated in Massachusetts a couple of years ago, there was overwhelming public support in favor of legalizing assisted suicide. The polls all indicated that their measure was going to pass hands down. But as people learned more about it and got beyond the initial rhetoric of compassion and they realized what exactly it is we're talking about, the measure actually failed. And those of us who are on pushing back saying, no, let's not take this step. The no's actually won. So as long as we can keep doing that, as long as we can point out the rest of the story, that there's something more than just the initial good sounding avoidance of suffering, pseudo compassionate response that the other side seems to want to offer, the better we can do pushing back against that and saying, you don't realize how this is going to affect other people. Do you realize what you're talking about? And start talking about it in a language that other people understand. If we can do that successfully, I think we will continue to see states stand firm. Many states have laws on the books against assisted suicide. So it's just a question of trying to hold the line there. The other side are the ones who are trying to change the status quo. They've got what sounds like a good argument at first, but we can push back against it. And so far, we've successfully done it in almost every place. You know, the Patients' Rights Council is a nonprofit. We don't deal with lobbying. We don't actually get involved in legislation. But what we do is we're called on to testify in state legislatures when this issue comes up. We hold seminars and we speak and write and do everything we can to educate people about the dangers of assisted suicide. And there are more and more people speaking out against it articulately and very forcefully. So I think it's good. The disability rights folks really do a fantastic job of this too, because they know firsthand what it's like to experience that degree of marginalization. And people will listen to them when they wouldn't necessarily listen to a white male like me.
Does that give you any hope there, Bobby?
Yes, it did. Extremely hopeful. I really appreciate that.
All right. I don't think Adam and Eve came from Scandinavia either. I think that was unfair to attribute Scandinavia as the source of all evil. All right, Bobby.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'm glad we could give you a little hope today on that front, Bobby. Nope, not that one. Ashley in Billings, Montana, listening on KJCR. You are on with Jason Negri. What's your question?
Well, I've worked for 23 years with hospice, and they are experts at pain control. And they also, it gives people time to say goodbye. It gives people time to mend fences. It gives them so much. But I have two friends. One is my daughter-in-law, and one is a friend, and they are for euthanasia because they are worried about financial issues. Will they work their whole lives and then not be able to pass it on to their family? Will the medical people take everything they have? And that's their fear. And how do you combat that?
Wow.
That's a hard issue, and it is an unfortunate reality. Everybody knows the high cost of medical care, particularly at the end of life. And the idea that what you had hoped would be your inheritance for your children and grandchildren is going to be spent on your medical care is really difficult for some people. I get it. I really do. But it might help for them to see how that very issue of the high cost of medical care is precisely what is pushing some unwilling people into this direction. There's a level of pressure there that should not be at play. And if people are really that concerned about leaving a legacy of some sort to their kids, look, nobody is saying that you have to have every medical intervention under the sun. That's a common misconception. A lot of people think, Catholics in particular, think that you have to do absolutely everything. And that's not true. The misconception that you're morally obliged to try every medical intervention and be hooked up to everything but the toaster until the power goes out. That's not the case. People simply can't square with the idea of their own mortality and say, you know what? Enough is enough. I'm not going to undergo this proposed treatment. It's not going to give me a reasonable hope of substantial benefit. It's going to cost a fantastic amount of money, and I would rather not go through that treatment and just be kept comfortable. They don't have to actually go all the way of paying for assisted suicide. It's not easy, I understand, but hopefully this is something. It's a double-edged sword. I get the altruistic motivation that people are trying to accomplish here by trying to save some money for their kids, so they'd rather just go through with assisted suicide. But it sets a terrible precedent for everybody else in terms of coercion and pressure. If we're going to allow the high cost of healthcare to make these decisions for us, we've already lost.
Ashley, God bless you in your work. Thanks for that question. Any response there to what Jason Negri had to say?
Well, I think he's helped me a lot. And you know, normally we have people 5 days or maybe 6 months is the criteria. And we have them not too long. Once in a while we have them longer. But, I think that's a good way to put it. And what he said is great.
Well,
thank you for your work in hospice. It's fantastic.
Ashley, it's some of the best work going on in the world today. And if you don't know about hospice, just look it up. It's a magnificent movement, and you should know about it. 888-318-7884 is our number if you prefer it in letters. 888-31-TRUTH. Jason Negri is our guest. Our topic this hour, Death with Dignity, the movement towards legalizing euthanasia and suicide. More on that when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers. Our success depends on you.
Today we live in an age of spiritual crisis. We all have friends and loved ones who don't practice their Catholic faith, who are torn by doubts, or who have left the faith altogether. So often at Catholic Answers, we get asked to recommend a book to help people like this. There are lots of good books that address specific issues a person may have, but very few are designed to be put into the hands of such a person, are short and easy to read, and cover a wide variety of reasons for the Catholic faith and its teaching. That's why we're publishing Trent Horn's new book, Why We're Catholic. In a series of brief chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe anything at all, and proceeding to cover science, the existence of God, the arguments for Jesus, and the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. We want Why We're Catholic to be that book, that one general book you can hand out to someone as a starting point for helping them find their way back to the church and to God. We even hope to distribute cases of the book in churches so people can take copies home to give to their friends and loved ones. To make your donation and get a free copy of Why We're Catholic, visit Catholic.com and click the Why We're Catholic banner, or call us toll-free at 888-291-8000. That's the Why We're Catholic banner at Catholic.com, or call toll-free 888-291-8000.
Where can you find the answers to hundreds of the most common questions about the Catholic faith? Catholic Answers 20 Answer Series, that's where. Clear, concise, and easy to carry, the 20 Answer Series from Catholic Answers Press offers hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. They're available individually, at special bulk prices, or you can get a starter pack of all 20 at a very special price. And remember, you can now purchase them as ebooks for reading on your mobile devices. Call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com today to get your copies of all the titles in this exciting new series, or ask for them at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Darren is a really good producer here, and so after this show on Death with Dignity, we have a show on Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory, Life After Death with Carlo Broussard. What a smart guy that Darren is. 888-318-7884 is our number here, so next hour, tune in or hang on, and Carlo Broussard will be here to talk about life after death. But we are talking about the very ends of life in this movement, often referred to as Death with Dignity, to entrench suicide and euthanasia in the law around the world, and certainly in the 50 states here in the United States. Joseph Negri is our guest, Assistant Director of the Patients' Rights Council. I'll just give that website out again because you should have it. It's www.patientsrightscouncil.org. And Jason, the calls are piled up, so it's all right with you. I'm just going to get straight to calls. Anonymous in Chino, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Anonymous, you are on with Jason Negri. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a registered nurse here in California, and I had a question in regards to patients that are on comfort care in the department. They're not necessarily transition into the facility of hospice, but they are provided with, for example, morphine drips or Dilaudid drips. And I wasn't clear for myself as a Catholic as to partaking into being able to administer the medication and titrating the dose. So, for example, the doctor will order a start off of a continuous drip of like a 1 milligram per hour. And then if patient shows any grimacing or pain, okay to titrate it another 2 milligrams. In other words, every hour, if you notice the patient is showing signs of pain, it is okay for the nurse to go ahead and give a higher dose. And I wasn't sure because I felt uncomfortable giving that, and I wasn't sure what the church stands on to giving medication for pain for these patients.
Well, that's a specific minutia issue that I don't think the church necessarily gets into, from my knowledge. I see no moral problem with giving morphine or any other type of palliative to alleviate a patient's pain. That's recognizably a good thing, isn't it? We're supposed to be taking care of people, particularly in the healthcare professions. That's what you do. So if a patient is experiencing pain and you're administering morphine or some other analgesic to combat the pain and give the patient relief, I see no moral problem with that whatsoever. And as far as increasing the dosage, that's a medical question. That's outside the purview of anybody other than that patient's doctor, whether the dosage is appropriate. If you have reason to believe that the dosage is wildly inappropriate and there's actually stealth euthanasia going on, well, that's something else entirely. But simply offering comfort and pain control to a patient who needs it, I think that's a wonderful thing.
Is that your concern, Anonymous, about the possibility of this actually being stealth euthanasia?
I felt like the patient was dying. And so instead of transferring the patient to a hospice facility, for example, they started the patient on the drip because the patient said they wanted to die at the hospital. And so that's where I felt uncomfortable.
Hmm. Nope. I think we...
Sounds like we lost her.
Oh, yeah. We just lost you for a quick second. But I think it's clear what you were saying. Jason Negri, any comment on that point?
Yeah. I mean, from what I could gather, it sounds like... I think you said the patient expressed a wish to die in the hospital instead of being transferred to a hospice or to another facility. And so long as the morphine drip wasn't being accelerated to the point where it was actually deliberately and affirmatively causing the patient's death, but it was simply trying to keep the patient comfortable, that's the line that really shouldn't be crossed. Whether or not it was being crossed in that case, I couldn't say. There's too many variables, and I'm not a doctor, and I certainly am not in a position to second guess that. But if there was enough going on there that you felt uncomfortable about it, that might be something you might want to take up with your supervisor or the HR committee or ethics committee or somebody else at the hospital, because that certainly is a line that should not be crossed.
And Anonymous, if I may suggest, the National Catholic Bioethics Center, they can help you with those specific types of questions. National Catholic Bioethics Center, I think nccb.org, and that's what they do all day. They answer questions of a very specific nature like that, where a person may have an ethical question about what's something that's happening in the bioethics area. Once again, the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Now, Jason, I want to ask you about that does raise a more public policy issue about pain management in general, the use of opioids. It seems like the medical community in one season is saying manage the pain and don't be cheap with the pain medications. And now it seems like there's a reaction to that. No, we have too many people becoming addicted. What are the public policy concerns there? And do you address them at the Patients' Rights Council?
Again, none of us are medical experts specifically. Our expertise is all in law and public policy. But the phenomenon that you're talking about is something that's not uncommon, and people bring that to our attention all the time. My understanding of it is that I think there was at one point a problem with the administering of opioids and patients developing an addiction to it. So there was a concern on the part of some doctors and healthcare professionals that we not go down this road, that we not give too much so as to addict the patient, which itself is a good concern. The problem is the pendulum perhaps swung a little bit too far in the other direction, and they're actually not administering enough to some patients. Morphine, of course, has there's a technical term for it that I'm not familiar with, but it has the quality of the patient can assimilate increased dosages of morphine and they become more less responsive to it, such that if you have a patient who's been on morphine for a long time for terrible pain, they can take more and more and more morphine just to keep on top of the pain. Whereas if somebody were to come in and have that dosage as their initial dosage, it would probably kill them right off the bat. But they build up a tolerance to it. The body definitely builds up a tolerance to a drug like morphine. So a doctor who is not familiar with pain control might shy away from prescribing what they think is too much morphine because the dosage would be unhealthy and possibly either lethal or cause an addiction. But if the patient, him or herself, has a history of taking morphine to deal with this pain, it might be totally appropriate to the situation. So it really has to be calibrated for the individual patient.
And at the very end of life, where we're talking about months or weeks to live, it's not – I mean, the addiction should not be a concern.
No, I think it's silly to – maybe not silly. I still understand it, but there's something odd about worrying about addicting a patient to morphine or any other type of opioid when they are so terminal that they're likely to die in a couple of weeks. It does seem a little incongruous to me.
But the doctors face pressures from every direction, including the Drug Enforcement Administration and their licensing boards. And there's no clear, probably, guidance where a doctor can say, I feel confident, I'm okay if I do this. And we need that.
No, unfortunately not. We do. I mean, and I'm a lawyer, and I feel bad because lawyers are probably at the root of it. The doctors are rightly so afraid of being sued by a litigation-happy society. And they do one thing that the patient's family doesn't want, and they fear getting sued for it. So whether they're given too much morphine or too little, they probably feel like they can't win. And many of them will err on – and frankly, that's also at the root of the overtreatment problem. You know, people talk about the high cost of medical care at the end of life. A lot of that is probably due to over-treatment, where patients are getting every test possible, every therapeutic. The doctors are throwing this, that, and the other thing at them, when in fact they're really not doing as much good. Their benefit that they're receiving from this is probably pretty marginal. But the doctors are afraid not to do it because they're going to get sued by the family as soon as the patient dies because they didn't do everything. It really is unfortunate, but that's the reality of our system.
But so I sense the idea that in order to get to a place where we actually take good care with good pain management of those who are in extremis, we actually need some legal reform in the country.
We probably do. Now, that's beyond the scope of this conversation and what the Patients' Rights Council does. I simply recognize that plays a role, I think, in why doctors are doing what they're doing. And the other problem with it is, as we touched on earlier, Americans' inability to square with the reality of their own death. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to do it. And that's one reason why they take advantage of every possible medical intervention available, is because they don't want to face the fact that they're mortal. And at some point, this is the end. There's a way to deal with death maturely, and we haven't reached that point yet.
No, indeed. Bill in Moorhead, Minnesota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Your question, probably as quickly as you can, Bill, because we're coming up near the end.
Wow. I understand. I'm 73 and I draw Social Security. We have an enormous bubble of people moving into Social Security, and we have almost a reduction going on in younger people. There's an enormous drain on entitlements. So I think what the government's going to do is they're going to make it into a patriotic act that if you will decide to end your life in some kind of scientific way, then you will open up a new door for the younger people to move into society. And they're going to turn it into almost like a patriotic duty to kill yourself. And it's going to be advertised, and there'll be TV shows about it, and there'll be special ceremonies and all this kind of faldera. And I really think that's where we're going.
Well, let's let Jason respond.
I don't know if that's where we're headed. I think I saw a movie about that years ago. Wasn't Logan's Run based upon something like that, where it was, you know, societally celebrated to kill yourself after you reach a certain age?
30.
It was 30 in that movie. Now, I don't know if we're headed there as a society at this point. I know the Inuit people are said to have put their elderly on an ice floe when they were no longer contributing members of society. I think we're doing that in our own way, maybe not legally and celebrating it as a patriotic act, but we're certainly looking at people and praising them, like Brittany Maynard, the cover story of People magazine, for her alleged bravery in taking that lethal medication. You know, she's hailed as a hero. And if that mentality keeps going, there's not going to be much left for the rest of us who just want to die naturally.
Jason Negri, thank you very much for being with us today on Catholic Answers Live.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I gave out the wrong email, the website address. It's ncbcenter.org, ncbcenter for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. I think I gave out the old National Catholic Bishops Conference address, ncbcenter.org. Now that we've dealt with the end of life, we will deal with life after death coming up in just a minute with Carlo Broussard. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.